The Life of Washington by Washington Irving, Chapter 24. Operations went on slowly in that part of the year's campaign in which Washington was immediately engaged, the expedition against Fort Duquesne. Brigadier General Forbes, who was commander-in-chief, was detained at Philadelphia by those delays and cross-purposes incident to military affairs in a new country. Colonel Bouquet, who was to command the advanced division, took his station with a corps of regulars at Raystown in the center of Pennsylvania. There slowly assembled troops from various parts. 3,000 Pennsylvanians, 1,250 South Carolinians, and a few hundred men from elsewhere. Washington, in the meantime, gathered together his scattered regiment at Winchester, some from a distance of 200 miles, and diligently disciplined his recruits. He had two Virginia regiments under him, amounting, when complete, to about 1,900 men. 700 Indian warriors also came lagging into his camp, lured by the prospect of a successful campaign. The President of the Council had given Washington a discretionary power in the present juncture to order out militia for the purpose of garrisoning the fort in the absence of the regular troops. Washington exercised the power with extreme reluctance. He considered it, he said, an affair of too important and delicate a nature for him to manage, and apprehended the discontent it might occasion. In fact, his sympathies were always with the husbandmen and the laborers of the soil, and he deplored the evils imposed upon them by arbitrary drafts for military service, a scruple not often indulged by youthful commanders. The force thus assembled was in want of arms, tents, field equipage, and almost every requisite. Washington had made repeated representations by letter of the destitute state of the Virginia troops, but without avail. He was now ordered by Sir John St. Clair, the quartermaster general of the forces under General Forbes, to repair to Williamsburg and lay the state of the case before the council. He set off promptly on horseback, attended by Bishop, the well-trained military servant who had served the late General Braddock. It proved an eventful journey, though not in a military point of view. In crossing a ferry of the Pamunkey, a branch of the York River, he fell in company with a Mr. Chamberlain who lived in the neighborhood, and who, in the spirit of Virginia hospitality, claimed him as a guest. It was with difficulty Washington could be prevailed on to halt for dinner, so impatient was he to arrive at Williamsburg and accomplish his mission. Among the guests at Mr. Chamberlain's was a young and blooming widow, Mrs. Martha Custis, daughter of Dr. John Dandridge, both patrician names in the province. Her husband, John Park Custis, had been dead about 3 years, leaving her with two young children and a large fortune. She is represented as being below the middle size, but extremely well-shaped, with an agreeable countenance, dark hazel eyes and hair, and those frank, engaging manners so captivating in Southern women. We are not informed whether Washington had met with her before. Probably not during her widowhood, as during that time he had been almost continually on the frontier. We have shown that with all his gravity and reserve, he was quickly susceptible to female charms, and they may have had a greater effect upon him when thus casually encountered in fleeting moments snatched from the cares and perplexities and rude scenes of frontier warfare. At any rate, his heart appears to have been taken by surprise. The dinner, which in those days was an earlier meal than at present, seemed all too short. The afternoon passed away like a dream. Bishop was punctual to the orders he had received on halting. The horses pawed at the door, but for once Washington loitered in the path of duty. The horses were countermanded, and it was not until the next morning that he was again in the saddle spurring for Williamsburg. Happily, the White House, the residence of Mrs. Custis, was in New Kent County, at no great distance from that city, so that he had opportunities of visiting her in the intervals of business. His time for courtship, however, was brief. Military duties called him back almost immediately to Winchester. But he feared, should he leave the matter in suspense, some more enterprising rival might supplant him during his absence, as in the case of Miss Philipsey at New York. He improved, therefore, his brief opportunity to the utmost. The blooming widow had many suitors, but Washington was graced with that renown so ennobling in the eyes of woman. In a word, before they separated, they had mutually plighted their faith, and the marriage was to take place as soon as the campaign against Fort Duquesne was at an end. Before returning to Winchester, Washington was obliged to hold conferences with Sir John St. Clair and Colonel Bouquet at an intermediate rendezvous to give them information respecting the frontiers and arrange about the marching of his troops. His constant word to them was forward, forward, for the precious time for action was slipping away, and he feared their Indian allies, so important to their security while on the march, might with their usual fickleness lose patience and return home. On arrival at Winchester, he found his troops restless and discontented from prolonged inaction. The inhabitants, impatient of the burdens imposed on them, and of the disturbances of an idle camp, while the Indians, as he apprehended, had deserted outright. It was a great relief, therefore, when he received orders from the commander-in-chief to repair to Fort Cumberland. He arrived there on the 2nd of July and proceeded to open a road between that post and the headquarters at Raystown, 30 miles distant, where Colonel Bouquet was stationed. His troops were scantily supplied with regimental clothing. The weather was oppressively warm. He now conceived the idea of equipping them in light Indian hunting garb, and even of adopting it himself. Two companies were accordingly equipped in this style and sent under the command of Major Lewis to headquarters. "It is an unbecoming dress, I own, for an officer," writes Washington, "but conveniences rather than show, I think, should be consulted. The reduction of bad horses alone would be sufficient to recommend it, for nothing is more certain than that less baggage would be required." The experiment was successful. "The dress takes very well here," writes Colonel Bouquet, "and thank God we see nothing but shirts and blankets. Their dress should be one pattern for this expedition." Such was probably the origin of the American rifle dress, afterwards so much worn in warfare and modeled on the Indian costumes. The army was now annoyed by scouting parties of Indians hovering about the neighborhood. Expresses passing between the posts were fired upon. A wagoneer was shot down. Washington sent out counterparties of Cherokees. Colonel Bouquet required that each party should be accompanied by an officer and a number of white men. Washington complied with the order, though he considered them an encumbrance rather than an advantage. "Small parties of Indians," said he, "will more efficiently harass the enemy by keeping them under continual alarms than any parties of white men can do. For small parties of the latter are not equal to the task, not being so dexterous at skulking as Indians, and large parties will be discovered by their spies early enough to have a superior force opposed to them." With all his efforts, however, he was never able fully to make the officers of the regular army appreciate the importance of Indian allies in these campaigns in the wilderness. On the other hand, he earnestly discountenanced a proposition of Colonel Bouquet to make an irruption into the enemy's country with a strong party of regulars. Such a detachment, he observed, could not be sent without a cumbersome train of supplies, which would discover it to the enemy, who must at the same time be collecting his whole force at Fort Duquesne. The enterprise, therefore, would be likely to terminate in a miscarriage, if not the destruction of the party. We shall see that his opinion was oracular. As Washington intended to retire from military life at the close of this campaign, he had proposed himself to the electors of Frederick County as their representative in the House of Burgesses. The election was coming on at Winchester. His friends pressed him to attend it, and Colonel Bouquet gave him leave of absence, but he declined to absent himself from his post for the promotion of his political interests. There were three competitors in the field, yet so high was the public opinion of his merit that though Winchester had been his headquarters for 2 or 3 years past, and he had occasionally enforced martial law with a rigorous hand, he was elected by a large majority. The election was carried on somewhat in the English style. There was much eating and drinking at the expense of the candidate. Washington appeared on the hustings by proxy, and his representative was chaired about the town with enthusiastic applause and huzzaing for Colonel Washington. On the 21st of July arrived tidings of the brilliant success of that part of the scheme of the year's campaign conducted by General Amherst and Admiral Boscawen, who had reduced the strong town of Louisbourg and gained possession of the island of Cape Breton. This intelligence increased Washington's impatience at the delays of the expedition with which he was connected. He wished to rival these successes by a brilliant blow in the South. Perhaps a desire for personal distinction in the eyes of the lady of his choice may have been at the bottom of his impatience, for we are told that he kept up constant correspondence with her throughout the campaign. Understanding that the commander-in-chief had some thoughts of throwing a body of light troops in the advance, he wrote to Colonel Bouquet earnestly soliciting his influence to have himself and his Virginia regiment included in the detachment. "If any argument is needed to obtain this favor," said he, "I hope without vanity I may be allowed to say that from long intimacy with these woods and frequent scouting in them, my men are at least as well acquainted with all the passes and difficulties as any troops that will be employed." He soon learnt to his surprise, however, that the road to which his men were accustomed, and which had been worked by Braddock's troops in his campaign, was not to be taken in the present expedition. But a new one opened through the heart of Pennsylvania, from Ray's Town to Fort Duquesne, on the track generally taken by northern traders. He instantly commenced long and repeated remonstrances on the subject, representing that Braddock's road, from recent examination, only needed partial repairs, and showing by clear calculation that an army could reach Fort Duquesne by that route in 34 days, so that the whole campaign might be effected by the middle of October, whereas the extreme labor of opening a new road across the mountains, swamps, and through a densely wooded country would detain them so late that the season would be over before they could reach the scene of action. His representations were of no avail. The officers of the regular service had received a fearful idea of Braddock's road from his own dispatches, wherein he had described that it is lying across mountains and rocks of an excessive height, vastly steep and divided by torrents and rivers, whereas the Pennsylvania traders, who were anxious for the opening of the new road through their province, described the country through which it would pass as less difficult and its streams less subject to inundation, and above all it was a direct line and 50 miles nearer. This route, therefore, to the great regret of Washington and the indignation of the Virginia Assembly, was definitely adopted, and 1,600 men were immediately thrown in the advance from Ray's Town to work upon it. The 1st of September found Washington still encamped at Fort Cumberland, his troops sickly and dispirited, and the brilliant expedition which he had anticipated dwindling down into a tedious operation of road-making. In the meantime, his scouts brought him word that the whole force at Fort Duquesne on the 13th of August, Indians included, did not exceed 800 men. Had an earlier campaign been pressed forward, as he recommended, the place by this time would have been captured. At length, in the month of September, he received orders from General Forbes to join him with his troops at Ray's Town, where he had just arrived, having been detained by severe illness. He was received by the general with the highest marks of respect. On all occasions, both in private and at councils of war, the commander treated his opinions with the greatest deference. He, moreover, adopted a plan drawn out by Washington for the march of the army and an order of battle which still exists, furnishing a proof of his skill in frontier warfare. It was now the middle of September, yet the great body of men engaged in opening the new military road after incredible toil had not advanced above 45 miles to a place called Loyal Hannon, a little beyond Laurel Hill. Colonel Bouquet, who commanded the division of nearly 2,000 men sent forward to open this road, had halted at Loyal Hannon to establish a military post and deposit. He was upwards of 50 miles from Fort Duquesne and was tempted to adopt the measure so strongly discountenanced by Washington of sending a party on a foray into the enemy's country. He accordingly detached Major Grant with 800 picked men, some of them Highlanders, others in Indian garb, and part of Washington's Virginia regiment sent forward by him from Cumberland under the command of Major Lewis. The instructions given to Major Grant were merely to reconnoiter the country in the neighborhood of Fort Duquesne and ascertain the strength and position of the enemy. He conducted the enterprise with the foolhardiness of a man eager for personal notoriety. His whole object seems to have been by open bravado to provoke an action. The enemy were apprised through their scouts of this approach, but suffered him to advance unmolested. Arriving at night in the neighborhood of the fort, he posted his men on a hill and sent out a party of observation, who set fire to a log house near the walls and returned to the encampment. As if this were not sufficient to put the enemy on the alert, he ordered the reveille to be beaten in the morning in several places. Then, posting Major Lewis with his provincial troops at a distance in the rear to protect the baggage, he marshaled his regulars in battle array and sent an engineer with a covering party to take a plan of the works in full view of the garrison. Not a gun was fired by the fort. The silence which was maintained was mistaken for fear and increased the arrogance and blind security of the British commander. At length, when he was thrown off his guard, there was a sudden sally of the garrison and an attack on the flanks by Indians hid in ambush. A scene now occurred similar to that of the defeat of Braddock. The British officers marshaled their men according to European tactics, and the Highlanders for some time stood their ground bravely, but the destructive fire and horrid yells of the Indians soon produced panic and confusion. Major Lewis, at the first noise of the attack, left Captain Bullitt with 50 Virginians to guard the baggage and hastened with the main part of his men to the scene of action. The contest was kept up for some time, but the confusion was irretrievable. The Indians sallied from their concealment and attacked with the tomahawk and scalping knife. Lewis fought hand to hand with an Indian brave whom he laid dead at his feet, but was surrounded by others, and only saved his life by surrendering himself to a French officer. Major Grant surrendered himself in like manner. The whole detachment was put on the rout with dreadful carnage. Captain Bullitt rallied several of the fugitives, and prepared to make a forlorn stand as the only chance where the enemy was overwhelming and merciless. Dispatching the most valuable baggage with the strongest horses, he made a barricade with the baggage wagons, behind which he posted his men, giving them orders how they were to act. All this was the thought and the work almost of a moment, for the savages, having finished the havoc and plunder of the field of battle, were hastening in pursuit of the fugitives. Bullitt suffered them to come near, when on a concerted signal a destructive fire was opened from behind the baggage wagons. They were checked for a time, but were again pressing forward in greater numbers when Bullitt and his men held out the signal of capitulation and advanced as if to surrender. When within 8 yards of the enemy, they suddenly leveled their arms, poured a most effective volley, and then charged with the bayonet. The Indians fled in dismay, and Bullitt took advantage of this check to retreat with all speed, collecting the wounded and the scattered fugitives as he advanced. The routed detachment came back in fragments to Colonel Bouquet's camp at Loyalhannon, with a loss of 21 officers and 273 privates killed and taken. The Highlanders and the Virginians were those that fought the best and suffered the most in this bloody battle. Washington's regiment lost 6 officers and 62 privates. If Washington could have taken any pride in seeing his presages of misfortune verified, he might have been gratified by the result of this rash eruption into the enemy's country, which was exactly what he had predicted. In his letters to Governor Fauquier, however, he bears lightly on the error of Colonel Bouquet. "From all accounts I can collect," says he, "it appears very clear that this was a very ill-conceived or very ill-executed plan, perhaps both. But it seems to be generally acknowledged that Major Grant exceeded his orders, and that no disposition was made for engaging." Washington, who was at Ray's Town when the disastrous news arrived, was publicly complimented by General Forbes on the gallant conduct of his Virginia troops, and Bullitt's behavior was a matter of great admiration. The latter was soon after rewarded with a major's commission. As a further mark of the high opinion now entertained of provincial troops for frontier service, Washington was given the command of a division, partly composed of his own men, to keep in the advance of the main body, clear the roads, throw out scouting parties, and repel Indian attacks. It was the 5th of November before the whole army assembled at Loyalhannon. Winter was now at hand, and upwards of 50 miles of wilderness were yet to be traversed by a road not yet formed before they could reach Fort Duquesne. Again, Washington's prediction seemed likely to be verified, and the expedition to be defeated by delay, for in a council of war it was determined to be impractical to advance further with the enemy that season. Three prisoners, however, who were brought in gave such an account of the weak state of the garrison at Fort Duquesne, its want of provisions, and the defection of the Indians, that it was determined to push forward. The march was accordingly resumed, but without tents or baggage, and with only a light train of artillery. Washington still kept the advance. After leaving Loyalhannon, the road presented traces of the late defeat of Grant, being strewn with human bones, the sad relics of fugitives cut down by the Indians, or of wounded soldiers who had died on the retreat that lay moldering in various stages of decay, mingled with the bones of horses and of oxen. As they approached Fort Duquesne, these mementos of former disasters became more frequent, and the bones of those massacred in the defeat of Braddock still lay scattered about the battlefield, whitening in the sun. At length the army arrived in sight of Fort Duquesne, advancing with great precaution and expecting a vigorous defense. But that formidable fortress, the terror and scourge of the frontier and the object of such warlike enterprises, fell without a blow. The recent successes of the English forces in Canada, particularly the capture and destruction of Fort Frontenac, had left the garrison without hope of reinforcements and supplies. The whole force at that time did not exceed 500 men, and the provisions were nearly exhausted. The commander, therefore, waited only until the English army was within one day's march, when he embarked his troops at night in Bateau, blew up his magazines, set fire to the fort, and retreated down the Ohio by the light of the flames. On the 25th of November, Washington, with the advanced guard, marched in and planted the British flag on the yet smoking ruins. One of the first offices of the army was to collect and bury in one common tomb the bones of their fellow soldiers who had fallen in the battles of Braddock and Grant. In this pious duty, it is said, everyone joined, from the general down to the private soldier, and some veterans assisted with heavy hearts and frequent ejaculations of poignant feelings, who had been present in the scenes of defeat and carnage. The ruins of the fortress were now put in a defensible state and garrisoned by 200 men from Washington's regiment. The name was changed to that of Fort Pitt in honor of the illustrious British minister, whose measures had given vigor and effect to this year's campaign. It has since been modified into Pittsburgh, and designates one of the most busy and populous cities of the interior. The reduction of Fort Duquesne terminated, as Washington had foreseen, the troubles and dangers of the southern frontier. The French domination of the Ohio was at an end. The Indians, as usual, paid homage to the conquering power, and a treaty of peace was concluded with all the tribes between the Ohio and the lakes. With this campaign ended, for the present, the military career of Washington. His great object was attained, the restoration of quiet and security to his native province, and having abandoned all hope of attaining rank in the regular army, and his health being much impaired, he gave up his commission at the close of the year, and retired from the service, followed by the applause of his fellow soldiers and the gratitude and admiration of all his countrymen. His marriage with Mrs. Custis took place shortly after his return. It was celebrated on the 6th of January, 1759, at the White House, the residence of the bride, in the good old hospitable style of Virginia, amid a joyous assemblage of relatives and friends.